Hey there, this is Virginia Prescott with producer Sarah Plourd.
Shh.
What? I mean, what?
We're having a secret drive.
Got it. If you love the show, consider making a small donation to the station where we make it, and we will send you some secret swag.
What is it?
I can't tell. It's a secret.
All right. Go to nhpr.org/support and chip in to get yours.
We're trying to keep things quiet, but we hope that you will make some noise for word of mouth.
The Word of Mouth podcast is brought to you by
Dartmouth Hitchcock. Imagine nationally ranked healthcare in your community.
With convenient locations throughout northern New England.
World-class providers are closer than you think. Visit dartmouthhitchcock.org to learn more.
Dartmouth Hitchcock is here.
Word of mouth.
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 Word of
mouth.
This is Word of Mouth from NHPR. I'm Virginia Prescott. Memorial Day is behind us, which means summer to us up here in New England. Time to head to the coast or the lake or find a local pool or swimming hole to cool off. The urge to jump into water may feel instinctive on a hot day, but it is a learned behavior among humans. Despite the ease of Olympic swimmers Michael Phelps and Missy Franklin's, humans are not, in fact, born to swim. And that's on a planet that's nearly three-quarters covered by water. All that natural water and more than 5 million residential pools and 1,400 water parks in the U.S. alone, we begin to understand more clearly why drowning is the fifth leading cause of death in this country. James McWilliams is an historian and author of the Things We Eat column at Pacific Standard. His piece, A Brief History of Drowning, is in Pacific Standard's Water Issue, and we reached him on Skype. James, welcome to the program.
Hello, thanks for having me on.
So what is our attraction to water then? Something that we weren't, according to the evolutionary biologists that you spoke to and others, that we weren't made to be in?
It's such an interesting question, and there's no consensus on the answer, but I think it's fairly safe to assume that our resources, as we developed as, you know, Homo sapiens, our resources were simply better spent, more profitably spent running, walking long distances and running in the effort to acquire food as hunters, as gatherers, as scavengers. And it's also, I think, quite possible that being in water may have ultimately been a very dangerous thing. You can't see what's around you. Unlike if you're standing on a hill overlooking a savanna, you have a certain level of safety because you can see clearly whatever potential dangers are around you. If you are in a body of water where there are all kinds of hazards, this is not the case at all. And so it's really quite possible that in terms of enhancing our safety as humans evolved, it just didn't make sense to learn how to swim, despite the fact that we were around so much water. The evolutionary biologists that I talked to all sort of gave me a version of one of those two explanations, and they seemed perfectly reasonable to me. And they also noted that we did wade into water to wash clothing, to, you know, to bathe, to fish. But in terms of actually learning how to swim, it may have been more dangerous and more energy consuming than was necessary in order for us to evolve as the human beings that we are today. You know, all that said, it still is a kind of compelling paradox. I mean, these kind of explanations only go so far. And, you know, on some level, there's always going to be a little bit of mystery as to why it is a healthy human being learns how to walk without any assistance whatsoever. But it really takes some work to learn how to swim. And that work gets harder as we get older. Research from my article, I attended an adult swim class, and it was really a remarkable thing to see because I watched these otherwise perfectly athletic adults walk around in waist-high water, absolutely terrified as to what they were doing. And it really hit home that we have very little in our, you know, DNA that's innate when it comes to swimming.
So good news, I guess, for people who don't take to the water like a fish. I guess we're not meant to.
That's the question that really got me interested in writing this article is, I mean, anyone who has raised children knows that between, you know, the period when your child is an infant and a toddler, they just naturally learn to walk. You don't have to do much to support that. And I kind of wondered why this was not true for swimming as well. And so that was kind of the paradox that got me interested in researching this article. And there are certainly all kinds of evolutionary explanations, some of them more hypothetical than others, as to why we don't naturally swim. But the fact is we don't. And as a result, it poses a bit of a problem, on one level, a public health problem that we could probably stand to be more vigilant about.
So how common is drowning? I mentioned the fifth leading cause, according to the CDC, of death here, but much worse, I guess, for children.
That's right. So, it varies according to the particular demographic that you're talking about. But with young children in particular, it is a very big danger, perhaps even the second leading cause of death between the ages of 1 and 5. The reason for that is, I think, we underestimate how easy it is to drown. You know, small children can drown in a few inches of water. And this isn't intended to be sensationalistic or create unnecessary fears, but it is to highlight the fact that, you know, again, because we don't have this natural inclination to swim, because we have to be taught to swim, and frankly, taught to swim well, you know, a single lesson isn't going to do it. The preconditions for these kind of accidents are far more pervasive than we might estimate them to be.
And of course, it's not just inability. It's, you know, sometimes it's not wearing life jackets or not supervising children well enough. But also, drowning disproportionately affects particular other populations in this country, like who?
Well, I mean, the obvious answer to that question would be groups of people that don't have access for socioeconomic reasons to swimming pools and swimming lessons. And in certain parts of the country, this falls heavily on African Americans. In other parts, it falls on Hispanics. It's not as clear cut as, you know, we might like it to be in terms of getting a better understanding of the problems. But, you know, my assessment in the end was that this really is a socioeconomic issue. Those who have access to the resources, the leisure time to pursue swimming lessons are far less likely to experience a drowning incident. One of the more interesting conversations I had in doing research for this article was with a couple of medical professionals at Seattle Children's Hospital who had taken a very careful look at why people drown. And one of the reasons that they found was that a lot of swimming pools have very specific requirements about what you can wear. They require a formal bathing suit. Well, a lot of groups of people swim in cutoff shorts and don't wear kind of formal bathing suits. And they're turned away from swimming pools and will often end up going to another body of water that doesn't have any sort of lifeguard protection. And as a result, will, you know, put themselves at greater risk. And so these medical professionals spend a great deal of time working to kind of liberalize what, or, you know, we are allowed to wear at swimming pools. So to me, that's very interesting because it raises sort of the most unexpected places to look for achieving swimming safety, even for those who already do know how to swim.
James McWilliams is with us. He's an historian and writer, and he wrote A Brief History of Drowning for the Water issue of Pacific Standard magazine. What are some other things that are being done to get the number of drowning fatalities down?
There are certain kinds of regulation fences that need to be put around private pools, and very often they're not. You know, really common sense stuff like that. The availability of life preservers, the number of lifeguards at a swimming pool. I mean, none of this is really rocket science. But I think probably the biggest one, and I think the reasons that there are a lot of drownings that could be prevented, is we're not very good at recognizing what drowning looks like. We have a kind of Hollywood idea of what drowning looks like, and that's usually a person screaming with their hands waving as they go down into the water. And in fact, that's not what drowning looks like at all. Again, going into this research, I sort of thought that's what drowning looked like, and coming out the other end, I realized it's really a dangerous misconception. What drowning looks like is actually the person will just be gasping. They will not be yelling. They will be gasping for air. Their head will be back, and they will assume a vertical position. And then I think most interestingly, they will actually, in that vertical position, push their hands down as if they were trying to lift themselves out of a ditch. And that's not something we really think about when we think about somebody drowning. So very often it happens and people are around and it's not recognized. I mean, you hear those stories quite a bit. There were many, many people around and a person drowned. How could that possibly happen? And I think a lot of it comes down to this misconception of what drowning in fact looks like. And, you know, the fact that we're not aware of that, I think, again, speaks to the general lack of education, even among those who have access to some of the best swimming instruction about what drowning looks like and how, you know, pervasive and you know, possible it is to drown, even for those who do know how to swim.
Well, you mentioned that the incidence of drowning is greater in populations or people without means, but I do know people who are, you know, fairly strong swimmers. One caught a couple of years ago in the undertow at Martha's Vineyard. So it is not by any means exclusive to people who don't know how to swim.
No, that's absolutely right. My own children, I have two children, and they're teenagers now, but, you know, my kids have had access to the finest swimming instruction available, and they're both very strong swimmers. But whenever I'm, particularly in a body of water, a natural body of water, if we're on a lake, if we're near a river, if we're in the ocean, just as a father, one of my greatest fears is that my children would drown. And I think it's a bit of an irrational fear, but at the same time, I have chosen to really listen to it and be kind of hyper-vigilant around water, I think often much to my kids' embarrassment. But the fact is that you're absolutely right, that even those who would seem to have all the bases covered in terms of avoiding drowning can still drown. And, you know, this is just to remind ourselves, particularly in summertime, that we must have a really healthy respect for the dangers involved in swimming. Swimming is a beautiful thing. I love swimming. And there's nothing in many ways kind of more elegant than swimming or watching somebody who really knows how to swim well. But nobody's immune. One woman I interviewed, interestingly enough, she was an African-American woman who didn't learn to swim until she was in her 40s, but took to it very well. In fact, her swimming skills progressed to the point that she was entering competitions and winning these competitions. And what I really took away from my conversation with her was her persistent fear, continued fear of drowning. She talked extensively about how every time she gets in the water, she is able to tap into that fear. And she thought it was a healthy thing. I mean, it still terrified her a little bit, but she was able to remember what it was like not to swim. And despite the fact that she was such a strong swimmer now, it persisted nonetheless. And I guess on some level, you know, what I'd like readers to take away from the article is that, you know, again, none of us are really protected from this danger. It's very easy to think we're not. And in fact, just this morning, I went for a swim in a nearby quarry, but I really thought to myself, don't swim out too far. Be very careful. I was the only one there. Mm. And so I think, you know, these just having that awareness is probably not not a bad idea.
James McWilliams, an historian and writer, thank you very much for speaking with us.
Oh, thanks for having me on.
James writes the Things We Eat column for Pacific Standard, and he wrote A Brief History of Drowning also for the Pacific Standard's water issue. There's a link to read it yourself at wordofmouthradio.org. This is Word of Mouth from NHPR. I'm Virginia Prescott. If a picture is worth 1,000 words, then what is the value of a good infographic? Bills and budgets, food or exercise habits, whatever the metric, today's spreadsheet junkies are obsessed with collecting and visualizing data about their lives. But what happens when measuring emotion? Robin Weiss is a user experience designer who quantifies her own life data as a sort of hobby. She tracked her crying for more than a year and then sorted it into patterns and analysis into an infographic-laden essay featured recently on Vox.com. Robin, welcome to Word of Mouth.
Hi, thank you.
So you did come up with a pretty rigorous system for rating your crying, tracking the root causes, the time, duration. Tell us a little bit about this system that you came up with.
Sure. I started just getting really basic information about each cry. I had to come up with a way to know what a cry actually meant. So anytime that I physically started crying, tears coming out of my eyes, that was kind of the baseline for a cry. So I would just kind of check the time when I started crying and check the time again when I stopped, and I would write a little note about what caused it. And then I had this intensity system, a scale from 1 to 5, to kind of rank how how much the cry affected me. One was the bottom of the spectrum, and that was just kind of, like I said, water came out of my eyes. Like, something made me cry. Maybe I just shed a tear or two. Mm-hmm. I wasn't, might not have been very upset about something. A five was the opposite end of the spectrum, and that's kind of like, I think that's what most people think of when they think about crying, like someone who's not composed and can't really breathe very well, and they're sobbing, and it's a much bigger deal.
As you put it, I'm a crumpled pile of flesh.
Yep.
The rest of the world is suspended in my anguish.
Yep.
So you converted this then from a spreadsheet, you know, your distribution, your duration, your location for 589 days. So how often did you cry each day?
On average, I cried every 3 days, but on those days that I did cry, I cried on average 2 times. But the average doesn't necessarily reflect the reality. Most of the times that I cried, it was usually just once. But then there would be bad days where I'd be basically crying all day. So it really depended.
What was the longest stretch then without crying?
I believe it was 23 days, so just over 3 weeks.
And the duration of cries, what was your sort of longest cry?
I think the longest that I had was 80 minutes. There were a couple days.
Imagine when you're doing it, sort of thing like, oh my God, I'm getting close to my record, 79 minutes.
You know what? Thankfully, I never thought about it that way.
Oh, good. But why did you even want to do this in the first place, to measure your crying?
I had a sense that I cried more than other people, and it was really confusing to me that I didn't think it was weird and I didn't think it was a big deal, but whenever I talked about it with other people, people kind of reacted strangely.
Actually, you say in the article, I've always considered myself to be a bit of a crybaby.
Mm-hmm.
Did you prove that?
I think so. I feel pretty confident that I proved I'm a crybaby.
Well, tracking, though, seems, you know, it's kind of objective. It's kind of emotionally distant in some way. Mm-hmm. And it makes sense when applied to something like calories or sit-ups. Crying, though, emotional, subjective. Did you ever feel like this project sort of put you at odds with yourself, the two sides?
Yeah, definitely towards the end of the project, which is why I ultimately stopped. I was too in my head about it. I was thinking too much about it. I was way too aware of the times that I cried, and I was kind of like exploiting it. So it went from being something that I was kind of logging somewhat objectively, like just as it happened, to something that I was, you know, I changed my crying habits, I think, as a consequence of logging.
Well, that's the thing. I mean, there's a lot of discussion about the quantified life, right, in the digital mm-hmm. age, you know, heartbeat, sleep patterns, eating. And I wonder if this made you think at all about that when you're so focused on tracking the experience of your life, do you actually spend less time living that life?
I think it really depends. It's similar to this kind of debate about whether taking pictures of something takes away from the moment. So by taking a picture, you're generating this physical thing to help you remember something and call back memories. But if you're taking pictures all the time, then some people might argue that you're not actually experiencing something. And I think it's similar with logging, where if it becomes too much of a big deal, then it does definitely kind of take away from your actual experiences. So I think it's all about finding the right balance.
So after you were finished collecting this data, you spent a lot of time analyzing, presenting it various different ways. We see a bar graph, you know, for popular crying locations, a color chart showing the frequency of cries by hour, day of the week. How important were these infographics in this process of quantifying data and understanding it?
Well, I'd say that a lot of the whole quantified self community is it's meant to focus on what you actually learn about yourself by doing these things. So I think the real self-reflection and self-knowledge came in when I looked at the emotions that were underlying everything. And that kind of helped me get at the original, like, curiosity. Like, what are the sorts of things that make me cry?
You did go through a breakup at this time.
Yes.
You also measured friend-related cries, family, mm-hmm. work, reflections. I was talking to somebody about this, and they said, this is cognitive behavioral therapy, right? You're sort of like, you know, I'm this big lump of emotion, but that you're sort of parsing it out and understanding its source. Did this exercise at all help you come up with strategies at getting at the sources of the crying?
Kind of, just because I had to go over, you know, hundreds of times that I was upset. And I did all of that later, like after all of the logging was done, that's when I went back and kind of tried to figure out what the actual emotion was, because the memory was so raw still. But I think going through that process hundreds of times and finding like fine points and distinctions between two similar but different experiences really helped me find the language to apply to past situations. So it is a little bit helpful now, but I still need time to like and distance to process things.
And you're good with that.
Yeah.
Well, Robin Weiss, thank you for speaking with us.
Yeah, thank you so much.
Robin Weiss, she collected more than a year's worth of her crying data and wrote about the experience for Vox.com. You'll find a link to that piece with some fascinating infographics and to her own website, where she's also collected data on her dating habits and more. All of that is at wordofmouthradio.org. This is Word of Mouth from NHPR. I'm Virginia Prescott. It is a skydiver's worst nightmare. You're 12,000 feet above the earth in a free fall. The world spins below and the chute does not open. So what do you do? What do you think? What do you feel? Well, this next story comes to us from producers Michael May and Lisa Tobin.
Hi, I'm Shirley Dygert. I'm a mail carrier, rural mail carrier in Groesbeck, Texas. I am not the kind of person that would naturally be drawn to skydiving. I'm not one to take chances like that.
I'm David Hartsock. I think for myself, it's kind of like therapy almost, because when you're skydiving, you can't be thinking about, did I leave the oven on? Oh my gosh, I got that paperwork that I got to do for work.
My older son had gone skydiving on his 30th birthday. So when my younger son, 2 years later, decided to celebrate his 30th birthday the same way, he invited me along. At that time, I just looked over at my husband, and he's like very wide-eyed looking at me. You're really going to do this? I says, oh my gosh, yeah, let's do it.
It was obvious she was nervous about it, so I tried to make it as lighthearted as possible.
He just come walking straight up to me, looking right in my eye, and stuck his hand out there and introduced himself.
One of the things I always tell my students to try to calm their nerves is that we're connected up there. There's no way the person's going to get away from me. So I told her that you can be sure that nothing's going to happen to you, because I'm going to make sure nothing happens to me.
And so we go taxiing off. We're like above the clouds. We're way up there. It looked like I was going to be doing this. Yeah.
We got to the door. I crossed our hands in front of her, tilted her head back against my shoulder, and rocked forward back in the plane, and out we go.
One, two, three. And we bailed out of the plane. We did a free fall for a while. You didn't feel like you were really falling. You felt like you were in a wind tunnel almost, or something like that. It's just very windy. And it was beautiful. I couldn't hardly wait till the parachute would open, and then I could just really get a good view of everything.
I deployed the primary parachute, and you're expecting to go into a nice, smooth glide, and instead we got hit like a brick wall. The canopy was flapping very hard because half of it had not inflated.
We were going around so fast and so hard. We were like laying out flat. We were going around like that. It just made me very dizzy.
I realized, well, I've got to cut this canopy away so it'll get away from us, and then I can deploy the reserve parachute. But the way the parachute had so violently opened, it had jerked the harness that she was in and the harness I was in, and the handle that should have been right accessible on the right side of my body had folded underneath the harness I was wearing.
And I could hear him grunting and trying hard. You could just hear him, trying hard to reach something.
And so that's when she asked me if everything was okay. And I was honest with her and told her no, it was not okay. That we had a serious problem.
And it's like the world stopped. And all I could think about was my husband not really wanting me to go. And why did I push for this? What is happening? I can't believe this might happen.
I realized that we were in a very, very serious situation, and it was probably not going to end well.
I thought about my mom. I had just lost my mom not too long before that, and I thought about seeing my mom again and knew I was going to. And then when I thought about my mom, I thought about my kids. My kids and my grandkids, 3 grandchildren, and my husband and my other son were on the ground watching this. And I just said, God, I didn't want them to have to see this. I just knew this was my moment, that this was my last day on earth.
Knowing that her 2 sons and her husband could see their mother and wife spinning into the ground thinking, oh my God, she's going to be dead. And I wasn't going to let that happen no matter what. At that point, you know, we were probably down to 3,000 feet, and I went ahead and deployed the reserve parachute. But unfortunately, all I did was get tangled up into the main parachute. I was looking down at the ground to see where we were headed. It's a pretty much a farm area, so there's houses, barns, barbed wire fences, all kinds of things you can hit that it's going to kill you. I had a brief thought about, well, this is my fate. Oh well, you know, the primary thing now is to make sure that at least one of us survives, and that one person that needs to survive is the student. And I figured what I would do is swing my body underneath hers so that that way she would land on me. The last 3 seconds, just as we were spinning in, I told her to raise her legs.
He said, get ready for a rough landing, Shirley. I was laying right smack on top of David. He was on his back on the ground. I was right on top of him. And I could hear him trying to breathe, like let out a hard breath. All I could think about is, oh my gosh, we got to help him get up. I didn't think about all that could be wrong with him. I just wanted him to get up.
When I woke up in the hospital, I think the first time that I can actually remember waking up, my mom was right there by my bedside, and because of the collapsed lungs, they had to do a tracheotomy, so I had a trach in my throat, so I couldn't speak, I couldn't move any of my limbs, but my mom was there, and she told me I was a quadriplegic. I had broken the bone in my neck, and that I was paralyzed from the chest down. I was thinking, well, that ain't so bad, you know, I'm still alive, which, you know, surprised the hell out of me.
So I went into the intensive care unit, and I talked with him. He couldn't talk. He had a deal in his mouth that he couldn't really talk, but his eyes told me everything. When he saw the neck brace on me, tears just ran down his cheeks. He felt so bad that I had been hurt. I could not believe it, that he could be so caring about everybody, and he was hurting so bad. But I hugged him at that time, and I kissed him on the side of his forehead, and I told him that I loved him. You know, I've always been the kind of person that kind of looked out for someone else, too. But this was so above and beyond anything you can imagine. Goodness, what could have gone through his head when we were going down, and he knew what was going to happen, and he was just trying to make sure that I got out of this okay. You know, he was going to take the whole brunt of it. I mean, for me, for me, I mean, little old me. Ever since this happened, there has not been one day that I have not thought about him.
And that story was produced by Michael May and Lisa Tobin for WBUR's Kind World series.
Word of mouth.
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 This is Word of Mouth from NHPR. I'm Virginia Prescott, and it is time for the latest installment of the 10-Minute Writer's Workshop. Richard Russo won a Pulitzer Prize for his novel, Empire Falls. That and Nobody's Fool were both adapted into film starring Paul Newman. Russo returns to the fictional working-class town of North Bath, New York, for his most recent novel, Everybody's Fool. I sat down with him on the darkened stage of an eerily empty theater before an extended interview at the Capital Center for the Arts in Concord.
Hi, I'm Richard Russo, and this is the 10-Minute Writer's Workshop.
Richard Russo, which is harder for you to write? Is it the first sentence or the last?
Well, sometimes the first sentence ends up being the last. that's an exaggeration, but I usually begin with a sentence that looks like to me it's going to be the beginning of the book, and then I get to around page 75 and a new character comes in and says something, and I realize, nope, this new character has to be there from the beginning, and so I write another new sentence, and then I cherry pick stuff out of those first 75 pages, begin again. This time I'll get to page 150 and the character will do or say something and I'll realize, no, that's the first thing in the book. I start again. This usually will happen to me at least half a dozen times. I don't think I have written a book yet where the first sentence that I wrote or the beginning, what I thought was the beginning of the book, turned out to be the actual beginning.
So it sounds like a lot of revisions, and you edit as you go along rather than writing it all and waiting until the end to edit?
That has changed over the course of my career. When I was a younger writer and didn't fully appreciate how difficult it was to write a novel, I had great, chutzpah, I guess, about a book. And I would launch in and I would write the world's ugliest paragraph and look at it and think, there's an expression that's used in the film industry, we'll fix it in post. And I used to be that kind of novelist. I just had this confidence that whatever was wrong could be fixed at any particular time. Now, in my 60s, knowing how many things can go wrong in a book, I really hate to build on a foundation that I know is not completely level, you know? Because a half a bubble off of Plum in the ground floor may not be anything, but you go up 17 stories and you can see that thing tilt with the naked eye. So now I spend a lot more time revising in the early going. It doesn't have to be perfect. I'm not a perfectionist. But it does. It has to feel like there are no major flaws in it that I'm going to pay for down the road.
So that's interesting. As many books as you've written, as practiced or disciplined a writer as you are, that you've become less cocky, which I guess is a good thing. Is there more humility in the process now?
Well, the process will teach you humility over the years. If you're lucky enough to work at something, and art, if you're an artist, whether you're a painter, sculptor, poet, fiction writer, screenwriter, if you work in the arts will humble you if you're paying attention. And you can, at the end of the process, as some artists do, you can pretend like you knew you were doing all along and that there was never a doubt that you would pull this off. But that's not the truth of the circumstance. The longer you work at it, the more humble you become about it.
So what do you think is the most common mistake that new or aspiring writers make?
I think that what my biggest problem was, and I do see it in a lot of young writers, is that self-consciousness, I think, is the enemy of art. And you cannot both write the story and watch yourself writing the story. You cannot be fully engaged with the characters in your novel even as you're wondering, is this good? Are people going to like this? What are they going to like best? What are they going to like least? Will it make any money? Will I be able to pay my bills? I mean, all of those are relevant real life questions. And you get to ask them, I suppose, when you're not writing. But when you are writing, you yourself have to get out of your own way. And I mean, we're all ambitious. We all want to write well, and we all want to be well thought of. But in the beginning, a writer really can get in his or her own way if you don't give yourself over completely to what your book is really about. And it shouldn't be about you.
Are there personal habits that you learned or would encourage new writers to take up?
Well, first of all, think of it as a job like any other in one sense. I mean, in some way, in the most important respect, it's more like a vocation than a job. But in a very basic sense, like any other job, you're not going to get paid if you don't show up. So show up. There are days when you're not going to feel like working, and work those days anyway. Don't get in the habit of saying, all right, I'll work twice as hard tomorrow. I'm going to take today off. I'll work twice as hard tomorrow. Or I'm going to take a couple of days off, and then, boy, I'm going to work the whole weekend through. The only thing that'll do is teach you how to hate the weekend. It's best, I think, for young writers in particular, not to be overly ambitious about how many hours they put in on a given day. If you write for an hour and a half, 2 hours, as I did, because that's all I could do as I was a teacher at the beginning. But if you have 45 minutes, that's what you have. If you have an hour and a half, you have an hour and a half. But you're really not going to need more than 2 hours of drafting on a story. If you do that, you know, 2 hours is going to give you two or three pages, which at the end of the week is going to give you 20 to 25 pages. And then factor that out 52 weeks a year, you're not going to have a book, but you're going to have something the size of a book. You don't need to do any more than that.
What is your personal worst distraction? What the thing that keeps you from getting work done?
Over the long haul, I have not really allowed myself to be distracted very much. I'm pretty religious about the way I go about things. My wife, God love her, and my daughters, God love them, have always understood that I need, you know, a couple of hours. And when I've turned in those, then I can, you know, do the other things in my life that need doing. Alexandra Styron tells this incredible story of her falling down the stairs in the family house. And she broke her arm, and it was dark in the cellar, and she didn't dare call upstairs into the house because her father was writing. I did not instill that kind of regimen on my family, but it is important for a writer to just find out what's going to get the work done and to not permit those kinds of distractions if you can help it.
What for you is the best environment for writing?
Well, boy, I used to love writing in coffee shops. When the phone rang, it wasn't for me. There was always a very pleasant ambient buzz of human conversation in there that I didn't have to listen to. You know, coming out of the fictional days into that kind of world is really reassuring in a way. And then came cell phones. Especially the absence on the other side, in the end of the line, where somebody else you know is talking, but you can't hear what they're saying. And you will supply that. In the silence, you will not only hear that one person talking on the cell phone, but you will supply the other side of the conversation, which makes it impossible for you to dream the deep fictional dream that you want. So now anymore, it's not perfect, but I've actually learned to work at home in my office, where when the telephone rings, it is for me. And where 1 minute I'm seated at my desk with a pen in my hand, and the next minute I'm standing in front of the refrigerator with the door open, with no memory of how I got there. So it's not ideal, but it's what I have.
What is the best advice you ever received about writing?
I don't know if this falls under the heading of advice or not, but it was the single most important thing I think a teacher said to me. My first novel, unpublished novel, unpublishable novel, and unpublished novel, I wrote when I was finishing up my degree in creative writing at the University of Arizona. And so I set that first novel in Tucson, and I gave it to my mentor to read, and he gave it back to me with the news that I was expecting. I knew it wasn't very good, and he told me that it wasn't. And he said, if there's a bright spot in this, he said, well, you're one unpublished novel ahead of an awful lot of people. And he said the other thing was that there was about 35 pages of backstory in the novel that took place in an upstate New York mill town. And he said, boy, that really came to life. You knew those people. And that was the knowledge, actually, that I had been running away from for a long time. Sooner or later, every writer has to ask himself or herself, who and what do you love? And until you answer that question, no amount of knowledge is going to get you where you want to be as a writer. It's only when you know who and what you love will your vision really take shape and your voice become genuinely your own and not just an imitation of somebody else's.
So when you're writing and in that period of struggle and, you know, six revisions in, do you have another fantasy job that you would like to pursue or like to have had rather than writer?
Maybe there's a more noble way to live a life than to sit by yourself all the time inventing people and what they say and do to each other when in fact there are real people out there who often need a lot. Yeah, and so what would that fantasy job be? Well, you know, it would be whatever you're thinking about at the time. You know, if you're thinking that poor children don't have a chance in this life, or that if you're thinking about the fact that you know, 60% of American children go to bed hungry, well, then you think, well, shouldn't I be doing something to alleviate that very particular problem for real people? And what it comes down to, of course, is that we all only have one life. And we make a choice. And I don't think I've made a bad choice. You know, I certainly enjoy my work as a writer. It's great fun. I've learned tremendous empathy from writing that I might not have learned any other way. And people tell me when they read my books that it often helps them in some way. So I don't have any regrets about the career path that I've chosen. I can't imagine, you know, on a day-to-day basis, looking at my life and thinking that I was put here to do anything else other than what I'm doing. But of course, there are those days, aren't there? There are those days when the painter holding the brush wonders if it's a brush that he should be holding and not something else.
Richard Russo there, author most recently of Everybody's Fool. To hear more episodes of the 10-Minute Writer's Workshop, you can subscribe to our podcast. You'll find a link on our website, wordofmouthradio.org. That's all we've got today, but before we go, want to let you know about the chance to see another great American writer and support the novelists and authors of the future. Russell Banks will be in New Hampshire next week. He's author of Affliction and The Sweet Hereafter, both adapted into films that you may know. He lived in New Hampshire for much of his turbulent youth and wrote so eloquently about that. I'm going to be interviewing him for a celebration/benefit for the Low Residency MFA in Fiction and Nonfiction program at SNHU. The interview is open to the public, but there will also be a reception and a dinner option to meet one of the most celebrated and I think most fascinating writers of our time. Again, that's Thursday, June 9th at SNHU. There are details at our website, wordofmouthradio.org. Well, we hope to see you there. But for now, I'm Virginia Prescott, and this is Word of Mouth from NHPR.
Word of Mouth is produced by Molly Donahue, Logan Shannon,
and Jimmy Gutierrez.
Our senior producer is
Taylor Quimby,
and our executive producer is Maureen McMurray.
The views expressed in this program are those of the individuals
and not those of NHPR,
its Board of Trustees,
or its underwriters. Word of Mouth is a production
of New Hampshire
Public Radio.